Chief Judge and the Associate Judges of the United States Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Honorable United States Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces is now open and in session. God save the United States of America and this honorable court. Please be seated.
Good afternoon. Today, the United States Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces meets Duquesne University School of Law. The McArdle Moot Courtroom has been transformed into a federal courtroom for this afternoon. We will now proceed with the case of the United States against Gardner. Counsel for the defense.
Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the court. My name is Captain Seth Director, and I, along with Lieutenant Colonel Stephen Hendricks, represent the appellant in this case. In the immutable words of the military judge, the videotaped testimony of KG is direct evidence of a material fact and is more probative than any other evidence. Remarkably, this improper admission of the highly probative videotape was ruled harmless by the Army Court of Criminal Appeals. With that as a factual guidepost, this court should find that, number one, the Army Court erred in finding the inadmissible videotape of KG harmless. Two, the testimony of the same nurse, Ms. Sievers, is inadmissible because it violated the appellant's Sixth Amendment right to confrontation. And three, CID's failure to advise appellant of his Article 31 rights materially prejudiced him. Turning to the first issue, the proper line of inquiry under the Chapman-Simmons analysis is whether it appears beyond a reasonable doubt that the error complained of did not contribute to the verdicts obtained. In light of that, I would ask this court to focus on three factors. Number one, whether the jury relied upon this inadmissible evidence. Two, whether the prosecutor used this inadmissible evidence during argument. And three, the overall significance of the inadmissible evidence, not focusing, of course, on the other evidence admitted at trial.
I'm intrigued by the order in which you've presented your issues. I understand they're one, two, three here. Does that order presume that that you think that the admission makes the case, decides the case, regardless of whether the Article 31 rights, however we rule on the other issues?
Yes, Your Honor.
So you lose on the other two issues you're presenting to us today. It doesn't matter that even with that other stuff in, the two statements and the nurse Sievers testimony, you win either anyway.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, so you're standing by issue one as your best issue.
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor. Well, the Army Court simply could not have found this harmless beyond reasonable doubt. This case presents actually an interesting and unique factual posture and procedural posture for contemplation of the harmless error doctrine, as it's the military equivalent of a bench trial, where the probative relevance of the inadmissible evidence was actually enunciated on the record by the fact finder. Ultimately, the military judge admitted the videotaped evidence under MRE 807, holding that the videotape was offered as material fact and was more probative than any other evidence. He specifically said it's direct evidence of the alleged act. The videotape allows the finder of fact to actually view KT's demeanor and her statements unfiltered by any other person's perception or memory.
Well, counsel, how is it more probative of the fact than what the appellant in this case put in his own statements?
Well, Your Honor, and this specifically addresses something that the Army Court found and actually in the appellee's brief. Appellant contends that this is not in fact a confession as elicited by the Army Court. If you actually look at these two statements, while they do admit to certain elements within the two different specifications of the one charge, they are not in fact confessions. He specifically states on numerous occasions that he did not have the intent to commit any sort of sexual act. And that's specifically where I would address this court to focus its attention on when making a harmless error analysis for the inadmissible videotape testimony. And I think that's in light of what the military judge actually found, which is it really demonstrates for him exactly what the significance of this videotape was. It allows him to see the actual alleged victim and hear from her directly instead of from either some other potentially hearsay evidence or from the few sworn statements of the appellant.
So what you're saying is that the only evidence of intent to gratify his desires comes through the tape?
Your Honor, I would say the tapes are definitely probative and relevant of the element of intent to gratify sexual desires. And I would
from the vantage point of a young child. as opposed to the judge inferring from what he put in his own statements that that's why he did what he did?
Well, and Your Honor, to some extent, the relevant portion here is what the fact finder, in fact, found. Obviously, that's from a Chapman analysis. That's the focus should be on the actual evidence that was not admitted instead of the evidence, the other evidence that was available at the time of trial. And again, this is really a unique posture because of the fact that not only was the military judge the finder of law in this case, he was also, in fact, the finder of fact. And that also coincides with what the actual prosecutor did during closing arguments. He not only cited to the videotape testimony on one occasion, but again, cited to the fact that this was not only relevant, but also lending credibility to, obviously, KG's assertions. And he, in fact, used this again during rebuttal after appellant made his closing statement. Finally, assuming that we even consider a sworn statement in this basically harmless error doctrine, again, the intent to gratify sexual desires was not satisfied by any other evidence. And if we look at specifically what the videotape testimony addresses, which isn't addressed by any other evidence, and I'll note for the court the indecent liberties, and this really related to appellant.
Can I just interrupt you for a second? I'm sorry. So when the appellant told the special agent that when he bathed his daughter and touched his daughter's private areas that he got sexually aroused to the point he had an erection, that's not any evidence of intent that he did this with the intent to gratify his own desires?
No, Your Honor. If you look at appellant's statement, basically what he alleged is while I was in the shower, and appellant's statement differs, of course, from KG's statements. He basically states that on two occasions, while I was in the bath with my daughter, I was washing her up, I touched her vaginal area, and I became somewhat aroused. And again, what he specifically states thereafter, I did not have the intent to sexually gratify myself. I did not do this in order to arouse myself. And this kind of coincides also with the military judge's eventual ruling, where he found actually two of the specifications, he found the appellant not guilty, including one of the specifications for indecent liberties. KT's videotape statement, if you look at it, indicates something very different. Appellant simply alleges that, while he was in the shower, he basically touched KG. But her statement indicates something very different. She, in fact, indicates that after the shower, while she was drying up, appellant actually used his hand to touch her vaginal area, which obviously is a very different factual predicate than some more amorphous statement of while he was washing her, he touched her vaginal area.
Counsel, I'd like to see if I can clarify what your argument is here in light of the questions.
Yes, sir.
Is your argument that the appellant's confession is insufficient as a matter of law under the Jackson standard to support a conviction, assuming that it's otherwise corroborated? Or is your argument that the confession is weak evidence of the issue of intent, and therefore the improper admission was prejudicial? Because it sounds like you're making the first argument rather than the second here.
I would assert, Your Honor, I think by Jackson standard you mean the specific intent to
That's right. It sounded like you were arguing that this isn't a question of the error being prejudicial in terms of weighing the remaining evidence. It's that you're arguing it's prejudicial in the sense of depriving the court-martial of any evidence upon which a conviction could be found, and that a court-martial could not even infer from those statements in his confession that he had the intent.
Your Honor, and to the extent that you just clarified that, I'm not going to go so far as to say there's no other evidence of that this court can basically circumstantial evidence of the intent. I would say, obviously, KG's videotape statement is especially relevant, as the military judge noted, highly probative of that issue. And that's in light, of course, of what the actual findings were under 807, and again, what the prosecutor eventually used in closing the argument.
So it's not the only evidence of intent.
I would say, from a circumstantial level, Your Honor, no. This court couldn't.
What's the other evidence? Please catalog it.
Absolutely, Your Honor. The other evidence available at trial is Mr. Lehman, who is basically the social worker who evaluated KG a few months after. Again, and the Army Court actually makes an omission or an error in how they analyze the evidence. What he said during the actual evidence portion of the trial was, basically, appellant made me touch a cooter or her cooter. The Army Court indicates something very different, which is appellant made me touch my cooter. Again, the only evidence that demonstrates that or indicates that KG was forced to touch appellant's cooter is the actual videotape testimony and the statement from Mrs. Sievers. If With the court's permission, I'd like to turn to the second issue now.
I just asked you to catalog the information, what else is out there. You're trying to convince us that the admission of KG's videotapes swayed the verdict, right?
Well, Your Honor...
You're trying to convince us of...
Your Honor...
sufficiency, or whether it swayed the verdict, or what? Whether it did not sway the verdict. The government wants to convince us it did not sway the verdict?
Your Honor, appellant's main contention is that KG, the inadmissible videotape testimony, had some effect on the actual verdict, which is standard under Chapman.
Do you know what the other evidence is in order to make that judgment?
Yes, Your Honor.
We're just going to walk away from it.
The other evidence available at trial, obviously, was a statement that KG made to her mother that was admitted under the excited utterance rule, that basically she came home, she went up to mommy and said, basically...
What about the nurse's statement?
And obviously, Mrs. Seavers, if that's what the court is indicating, then Mrs. Seavers' statement was basically, I saw Daddy naked, I touched Daddy's penis, Daddy's
right,
penis got bigger.
That, why isn't that persuasive? How do you get past that on harmlessness?
Well, again, appellant has specifically had this court focus not on the other evidence available at trial, but in fact on what was eventually ruled inadmissible by the Army Court, and not only that, but the Army Court and the military judge's own ruling on that evidence and why it was probative of the actual offenses.
But as a matter of principle, would you agree that if the other evidence is overwhelming, for example, this is just for the sake of argument, then you can't demonstrate that the error was harmful, right?
Well, Your Honor...
You have to demonstrate to us that it's not overwhelming.
Well, Your Honor, appellant would actually take a different position, which is the position under Chapman is whether or not the inadmissible evidence had some effect on the verdict, not whether or not the other evidence available at the time of trial was overwhelming or not. Even if we evaluate it from the overwhelming evidence, as this court has just enunciated, I still believe that...
I'm not giving you the test. I'm trying to get you to give me the test.
Yes, Your Honor. And again, the test under Chapman and this court noted in Simmons is whether or not the inadmissible evidence had some effect or had a effect on the verdict obtained. And obviously, appellant feels...
As to the outcome or just any effect, because all evidence has some effect, including evidence that one doesn't weigh.
Well, obviously, to the verdict obtained, and appellant specifically cites the two specifications to which appellant was ultimately found guilty to demonstrate that. And as Your Honor noted, obviously, the same nurse, Ms. Seavers, did in fact give testimony, and that testimony was in fact, Daddy made me touch him, Daddy's penis got bigger when I held onto it. Appellant would assert that this court should find that was in fact hearsay testimony, that it's inadmissible, considered testimonial hearsay, under any classification of Crawford v. Washington. Obviously, Crawford established certain core classes which would be considered in fact testimonial, and it also noted that obviously any statement a certain statement would be considered testimonial under any circumstances if it was in fact considered a police interrogation. The Supreme Court in the United States versus Davis recently went on to hold that statements that are testimonial under circumstances objectively indicating that there is no such ongoing emergency and that the primary purpose of the interrogation is to establish or prove past events potentially relevant to later criminal prosecutions. Under that analysis, the appellant would therefore ask this court to look at four main points when evaluating whether or not the statement should be considered a police interrogation under Crawford and Davis. Number one, the immediacy of the statement. Two, the formality of the statement. Three, the objective state of mind of the witness. And we can look towards page 2277 under Davis for that kind of analysis, the reasonable listener. And finally, four, the objective purpose of the questioner. Such factors are somewhat analogous to what this court has recently enunciated in United States versus Rankin. I think the critical distinction between United States versus Rankin, where it was really analysis under that third factor, that objective witness of the core classes and the analysis under a police interrogation, is the focus on the objective state of mind of the questioner versus the focus on the objective state of mind of the witness or the declarant for that matter. When we look at the four factors under immediacy, obviously this later same nurse investigation was conducted 3 days after the initial complaint. That initial complaint, in fact, involved a medical examination by a Dr. Kine, and he not only evaluated KT, but found no signs of physical abuse. Therefore, obviously, there was no immediate threat of some sort of medical need. Two, there was already a restraining order in place. The night that appellant was, in fact, accused of the offense, they removed him from his actual house.
But on the immediacy, you're saying that weighs in your favor because there is no immediate need for medical care?
Yes, Your Honor. I mean, if you look at the what basically Davis evaluated is whether they were recollecting past events or basically present events. In an application to, let's say, a medical hearsay exception, the critical factor here is whether or not there was, in fact, a present need for some sort of medical diagnosis or care. In this case, she had already...
So if you're a child victim, you either get your medical care the next day or you never get it?
Well, as this court noted in the United States versus Rankin, this is obviously contextual analysis. So in and of itself is not a per se, does not make it per se testimonial. But in light of the other, in fact, evidence available...
Are you saying this was a subterfuge?
Your Honor, I think what and correct me if I'm mistaken, the analysis for the medical exception policy to the hearsay rule, whether or not there could be a proper ruling for under the medical diagnosis, appellant asserts that there could be the primary question or the critical question under a Davis and Crawford analysis is not necessarily whether or not there was an alternative or derivative purpose, it's whether or not the primary purpose was towards criminal prosecution. If we look at it from the immediacy standpoint, obviously a restraining order was in place. Therefore, there was no present physical danger to KT after the incident. And obviously the second interview occurred 3 days thereafter. And also, it's replete from the record that KT was actually complaining of any physical ailments or maladies, therefore making the second medical diagnosis really not relevant.
Counsel, could you please address the government's request that we adopt a reasonable witness standard as set forth in the Stahl and De Oliveira cases that they've cited?
Yes, Your Honor.
What's the defense position on that?
The defense position really is threefold. Obviously, when we're talking about, we are definitely talking about an objective standard here. And what the prosecution wants to do is put that objective witness into the state of mind of a child, a five-year-old child. Appellant's contention is, once we do that, that's no longer an objective standard, that's a subjective standard. That's us placing us into the mindset of the actual victim instead of taking a objective perspective on it.
Well, isn't the government arguing the objective child? I mean, is there such a thing, can't there be such a thing as the reasonable child? You went from objective, reasonable man to subjective child. There's nothing in between?
Your Honor, I would say for the purposes of Crawford Davis, and if we look at the language under Craig v. Maryland and also under Crawford, it's apparent that Justice Scalia does not believe in such a child exception. And it really is untenable in this case, because there's really no evidence of what this objective child would in fact know or not have knowledge of. And appellant would contend that if we do look at it objectively, a five-year-old would in fact know that she was being interviewed for the purposes of some sort of prosecution. She had already been interviewed by multiple detectives at the time. She had just gone through a videotaped interview with a detective and a sane nurse. Her mother had originally told her not to say anything about the incident.
Well, wait a minute. You're talking about an interview with a nurse and a five-year-old child who there at least is some evidence of developmental delay. And you're saying that a five-year-old developmentally delayed child should have a state of mind that she knows that this thing is being conducted for the purpose of gleaning evidence?
Your Honor, appellant's contention is once we start putting ourselves in the mindset of a five-year-old...
Well, but isn't that one of the... You're talking about state of mind of the witness. That's one of your factors.
Yes, Your Honor.
What's the state of mind of this witness?
Your Honor, the objective state of mind of the witness would be taken from the factual scenario, what the questions were asked and how they were answered, not her age or mental infirmity. And that's what we really begin to get into here, is if you make an exception for a five-year-old, what's to say you don't make an exception for a 40-year-old or an 80-year-old or somebody who was on some sort of medication at the time or somebody who was sleepy? It's just an impenetrable...
Are you saying the reverse is simply positing rationality? What are you saying?
Your Honor, the defense's contention is really threefold. Number one, the objective witness should be an objective person, just as enunciated by Davis and Crawford, not an objective child witness. Two, there's nothing in the record that would presume that there's an objective child perspective where we would even know what a five-year-old would have knowledge of or not have knowledge of. And three, if you look at the medical diagnosis and treatment exception to the hearsay rule, it requires a showing that an objective witness would understand that this is used towards a medical diagnosis. So under that presumption, if the appellee is now arguing that this person, in fact, or this child would not, in fact, understand that this would be used towards criminal prosecution, but would understand that this would be used toward a medical diagnosis, that's just an untenable position, and it's illogical.
And the person questioning you is a nurse in a medical setting, you don't think the child would, insofar as the child drew any conclusions at all, wouldn't be concluding that the setting, that the purpose was medical?
No, Your Honor. And actually, if you look at the questions, and it's specifically what addressed in Crawford v. Davis, which is what are the questions asked and the questions answered. Prosecution Exhibit 1 specifically cites that basically what prompted that the testimony was a question from the Ms. Sievers, and it basically said, are you familiar with what just occurred between you and Detective Larson, Kenneth the policeman? And that's what, in fact, prompted the testimony, indicating, of course, that she understood that this would be used towards criminal prosecution or towards investigation.
Can I ask you why it is that you are focusing on the objective belief of the child as opposed to the objective belief of the people asking the questions, and why I haven't heard anything from you about the fact that this was not just a nurse but a sane nurse?
Yes, Your Honor, and I apologize. That's really the third factor I would have this court look towards. And obviously, in Mrs. Sievers' description of what she did, she classified herself obviously as a child abuse expert at the time of trial. She was a clinical forensic, meaning for trial, specialist, and she was coordinator of all the same. She had been practicing singing for 8 years and had conducted hundreds of versions, and more importantly, she had in fact testified in approximately 50 court martials. She obviously stated one of the purposes of her evaluation was to conduct, number one, forensic evaluations and detailed medical examinations. And what's particularly relevant in this case is that Detective Larson, in fact, was the one who set up the appointment. And obviously this occurred, the interview between Mrs. Sievers and KG occurred immediately thereafter, or approximately 2 hours after the initial videotaped interview between the detective and KG.
Is it more important that the detective set up the appointment, or is it more important that the very function of a sane nurse is to assist in law enforcement activities with respect to allegations of child sex abuse?
Yes, Your Honor, and appellant would ask that this court adopt that position, specifically in light of her testimony that she was in fact a forensic specialist, indicating that, of course, that was going to be used towards prosecution.
Well, my question wasn't a yes or no. It was which is more important, the fact that the detective made the appointment, or the fact that the function and purpose of the sane nurse?
Obviously, Your Honor, the function and purpose, that the primary purpose of the person interviewing was for criminal prosecution.
Counsel, along the same lines, my question is, why do we focus on the witness at all? In Hammond, the Supreme Court said that statements are testimonial when the circumstances objectively indicate, in that case, no emergency, and that the primary purpose of the interrogation is to establish or prove past events potentially relevant to a later criminal prosecution. If, and this is a matter that we'll have to decide, but if we were to conclude that the primary purpose here was a police interrogation purpose, what difference would it make what the mindset was of the person being interviewed?
I understand, Your Honor, and actually, I think my pleadings to the court indicated that as the primary factor here, the primary purpose of the questioner. Upon evaluation of United States versus Davis, specifically 2277, there was some indication of the consideration of basically the reasonable listener. So the extent that is somewhat of a factor in the determination under Davis of testimony versus non-testimony, I would say that's to a large extent, a secondary factor into the question of the mindset of the questioner.
To be clear, you're arguing a range of factors and not a dispositive test.
Yes, Your Honor.
I think you're running out of time, so
yes,
can I ask you a question about the third issue?
Yes, Your Honor.
On the rights warning sheet before the January 7th interview, there is the comment at the bottom, have you ever been advised of your legal rights within the past 5 years? You know, what I'm referencing.
Yes, sir.
And you're not the government, I don't believe, is arguing that that's a cleansing warning, but it is a relevant factor in assessing whether there's attenuation between the January 3rd statement and the January 7th statement. What are your two or three best arguments on why that should impact on our analysis?
Yes, Your Honor, and as this court indicated, that is not, in fact, a cleansing warning. And we would also
I characterize the government's, I think they can speak for themselves. I wasn't saying what it was, I said I didn't think they were arguing that it was a cleansing warning.
Yes, Your Honor. And permission, I noticed that I'm running out of time. Permission to
have I think there you go. Just ran out.
I'm sorry. That's it. Yeah.
No, we will invite you to take the time you need to answer Judge Baker's question, and you'll have an opportunity on rebuttal.
Thank you.
We have a concluding remarks.
Thank you, Your Honor. The other factors I would have this court look towards, in United States versus Phillips, United States versus Say, and United States versus Kianto, address these totality of circumstances. The other factors I would have this court look towards are the fact that this second interview was conducted by the same investigator, Special Agent Phillips. Two, the fact that Special Agent Phillips was one who, in fact, called him up, invited him down to the CID station, and this occurred only 4 days after the initial interview. And obviously, during the actual motions portion, appellant actually stated that the cat was out of the bag. He knew that his first statement was in, therefore he had to make the second statement.
Well, what's the appellant's pay grade?
It would be B6.
Okay. And I'm, you're giving me your litany of arguments, and I'm asking a specific one, which is whether or not this is a cleansing warning, does it not put him on notice that there's something wrong with the January 3rd statement, or potentially so, and yet he proceeds in any event?
Well, Your Honor, appellant would contend no, and if we look at the motions portion, he specifically stated he could not understand that the first statement could not have been used against him, and that he basically gave that second statement because he had to clarify the first statement. So the extent that it's not a cleansing statement but is somehow relevant, appellant would contend it's not. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. The court will now hear for counsel for the amicus.
May it please the court, Chief Judge Efren, good afternoon. My name is April Trimble. I am a student here at Duquesne University, and it is my true honor to appear before you today as an amicus in this case, arguing in support of the appellant, Staff Sergeant Gardiner. Fully appreciating the breadth and complexity of this case, my inquiry today is a narrow one, focusing on a single issue before the court. At trial, testimonial hearsay statements made by KG, the alleged victim, were admitted through the testimony of Ms. Valerie Sievers, a contract employee of the investigating sheriff's office. KG herself did not appear at trial to testify, and as the court below found, KG was not unavailable to testify, and the defendant had no prior opportunity to cross-examine this witness against him. As such, I respectfully request this court to find that KG's statements were admitted at trial in violation of the defendant's confrontation rights under the Sixth Amendment to the United States Constitution. The United States Supreme Court in Crawford v. Washington fully expounded the meaning of the Sixth Amendment's Confrontation Clause. While the court gave us a relatively simple rule, it left a key term somewhat undefined. The court told us that testimonial hearsay cannot be admitted at trial unless the witness is unavailable to testify and the defendant had a prior opportunity to cross-examine her. Now, as I mentioned, the court...
I'm sorry, do you think that the Supreme Court later answered its question as to what testimonial means in Davis versus Washington?
I don't know that in Davis versus Washington the court necessarily gave us an all-encompassing test, but I think they exemplified maybe what the key question raised by the Confrontation Clause and by Crawford really is. And I think the focus that I would like the courts to think about today is that the Sixth Amendment is at its very basis a procedural guarantee. And I suggest to the court that we can best determine whether statements are testimonial, not by scrutinizing the statements themselves or by speculating as to the full subjective intentions or understanding of the parties involved, but rather by objectively examining the procedure, the process that elicited these statements.
Do you have a cart and horse issue here, though? The process, are you arguing the process then determines whether it was testimonial, or if it's testimonial, then you get that process?
I think...
Don't you have to decide it's testimonial before you determine the correct process?
Your Honor, I don't. I think if an objective observer of the procedure that elicited the statement and then introduced it at trial would see this as an ex parte examination, gathering evidence from a witness, and then introducing those statements at trial through a government agent, then this procedure is precisely what the Confrontation Clause...
But the first part of that is testimonial, right?
The fact that it was an ex parte examination?
I mean, isn't that the A followed by the B?
I suppose so. Then the testimonial statement the testimonial statements themselves do not violate the Confrontation Clause. The violation occurs whenever the statement is admitted at trial, not through the witness themselves, but through the government. And in this case, I suggest that regardless of KG's subjective level of understanding of giving testimony or the concept of memorialization, that she was being systematically questioned for the purpose of gathering and collecting evidence to be used later at trial.
Are you asking us to adopt Justice Thomas's dissent in Davis, which is that if you have formal procedures, that you need to have formal procedures in order for something to be testimonial? Is that what you're suggesting?
Well, I think Justice Thomas's dissent in Davis really reiterates some key factors of Scalia's opinion for the court in Crawford, which is to focus on the real purpose of the Confrontation Clause, which is to protect our adversarial system and to not improperly import features of an inquisitorial system by allowing the government to go and collect evidence outside of court and present it in court through the mouth of government agents. And here, I think an objective observer would see that this was an ex parte examination eliciting testimonial statements. The key facts and the sequence of events that I would like to draw the court's attention to would be that it was on December 29, 2001, that KG first reported to her mother improper conduct on the part of the appellant. And on that night, December 29th, her mother took her to the hospital where she was seen and treated medically. 4 days later, the sheriff's office on January 2nd initiated its criminal investigation. It began that investigation on January 2nd by bringing KG to the Child Advocacy Center, where she was first questioned for several hours by Detective Larson, the lead investigating officer in this case. After that first session of questioning, a second session followed, this time by Ms. Severs, who was hired by the sheriff's office for this purpose. Now, Ms. Severs is a sexual assault nurse examiner and a clinical forensic specialist.
Would you argue, or what is your view as to whether there is more than one purpose for Ms. Severs' review?
I believe that an interview and statements can be multi-purpose. And the subjective purpose of the person asking the statement or the subjective purpose of the person giving the statement may be relevant, but only to a broader inquiry.
So can we, if we stipulate that there was a medical as well as a law enforcement purpose for the interview, for the nurse interview, how do we determine whether we even should determine which was the primary purpose?
I think the primary purpose question is important, but here the statement may have had some other purposes. But I would argue that in this case, the primary purpose definitely was to prepare for trial. And Ms. Severs no doubt wanted to also help this child, as probably would any other criminal investigator. But the sequence of events...
Well, she is a nurse.
Correct.
So she's not a criminal investigator, she's a nurse. What would you point to in the record to indicate that she is a nurse playing the role of an extension of criminal investigation versus a nurse providing, as a primary purpose, medical assistance?
Well, she is a clinical forensic specialist. She was hired by the sheriff's office, and she described herself, her function as one primarily of evidence collection.
Didn't we hold in Rodriguez-Rivera that who hired her at whose behest we were working was not dispositive?
It's not dispositive, but I do believe it is relevant evidence. And in this case, she was clearly eliciting these statements with an eye toward trial. And as far as addressing the government's proposed standard of looking at the subjective state of mind of the witness, I suggest that even in this case, the 5-year-old KG, after being questioned for several hours by a policeman regarding her father's conduct, even the 5-year-old would not think that this was suddenly transformed into some type of doctor's visit just because a sexual assault nurse examiner was now questioning her. Ms. Severs' medical background may be something that KG was not even aware of, and I think it is also telling that when Ms. Severs asked KG, "Do you know why I'm talking to you?" KG's response wasn't, "Because somebody hurt me and you're going to help me feel better." What KG explained to Ms. Severs was, "Daddy was naked, I was going to tell Mom." That's why KG said she was there. She was not an individual initiating this discussion with the nurse seeking comfort or cure, but rather she was a witness, whether or not she subjectively had the level of understanding to know that she was, and she was bearing testimony against the accused.
Well, are you saying that her subjective understanding is important, or are you saying that we simply take an objective look at the totality of the circumstances, which is what I thought you were saying?
I would advocate for the objective approach, but I think that, while not dispositive, the declarant's state of mind or purposes may be relevant. in this inquiry. It cannot be the dispositive factor because the Confrontation Clause, as I said, is a structural guarantee. It's concerned not with a particular type of witness or a witness of a particular aptitude, but simply says that the accused shall enjoy the right to be confronted with the witnesses against him. And as counsel for the appellant pointed out, to recognize some sort of blanket exception for children, we would have to extend that type of exception to witnesses who were drunk or who were otherwise of questionable competence simply because they may not be cognizant at the time they're making the statement of the fact that it will be used later in a prosecution.
In terms of the structural guarantee, is it possible